You're listening to Idaho Matters.
But this is not Gemma Gaudette.
Gotcha.
It's Joel Wayne.
And LD from the podcast You Know the Place.
We're producing season 6 right now.
Woo-hoo.
And we need your suggestions. Places to visit that you maybe pass by all the time, but you've never stopped into.
Places that you want to know what's their business?
What do they sell? Who goes in there? How do they stay in business? All those questions.
All valid. What are you seeing out there? Where are we going?
Send us your suggestions. You can send them on Instagram at You Know the Place.
Or shoot us an email. Send it to youknowtheplacepodcast@gmail.com.
We want to know.
Okay. Now here's Gemma.
From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. Could Idaho be in another surge? Well, Ada County COVID-19 transmission levels are high once again. So what does that mean? Well, here to answer those questions is Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. Now, remember, if you have questions for Dr. Pate, send them our way. Email us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Dr. Pate, good to have you back on the program.
Thanks, Gemma.
So, Dr. Pate, let's start with what I mentioned, and this is that Ada County is now at this high transmission level. This is according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines. So what are we seeing right now?
Well, we're seeing quite a bit of disease transmission. So lots of infections. And, you know, we've talked about this before, Gemma, that I'm not surprised about this because, number one, the variants that we're dealing with are the most transmissible viruses that we've dealt with so far during this pandemic. Number two, we've seemingly relaxed all of our precautions. Number three, a lot of people have tuned out. You know, they're not, they think the pandemic's over, they're not paying attention. You know, a lot of people are under this mistaken impression that COVID is seasonal, so we don't have to worry about it during the summer. And so all of these things have kind of lined up for the fact that, you know, we're having yet another surge, and it's due to a number of circulating Omicron sublineages.
And Dr. Pate, I want to give some statistics here for people who may be thinking, well, you know, life is returning to normal. You know, we deserve this break. And I think we all feel that way. But if we look at the 4th of July, the average number of daily deaths from COVID-19 in the U.S., it was hovering around 360. Now, if we look at this exact time last year and where we were in a similar kind of summer lull, it was around 228 in early July. Now, here's the difference. There were far fewer reported cases at this time last year, fewer than 20,000 reported cases a day. This year, it's about 109,000 a day, likely higher than that because most people are testing at home and that is not being reported. I do not want to be an alarmist by any means. But with that said, Dr. Pate, I mean, we're not, this is, I don't know if it's ever going to go away at this point, frankly.
Well, so Jimmy, you brought up a number of really good points. Number one is that I think the American public, frankly, this is a world phenomenon, not just the U.S., but many people have just become lulled by these numbers. These numbers of deaths are no longer shocking to people. And, mm-hmm. you know, they have become accepted. You know, that's the price of our freedom, so to speak, you know, that we don't have to take restrictions. We don't have to take precautions. And, you know, we're willing to, you know, sacrifice that there's going to be a certain number of deaths. And so one can understand that because we've done that before with other diseases, we just kind of accept it. But I think that the problem is that people, and we've talked about this before too, Gemma, that people look at this as kind of a binary kind of situation. In other words, you know, people are either dying or they're not. And, and of course, as we've talked about so many times, there's so much more. And I think that is the difficult reckoning that our country and many parts of the world are going to have to come to grips with as we better understand what is the toll that infection is taking on the health of our population. We've talked about so many different things. We've talked about long COVID. And of course, if you don't have long COVID, if you don't know someone with long COVID, you may think, well, you know, that's no big deal. That's not a big threat. It actually appears to affect a substantial part of the population of those that get infected. Another thing that we've talked about is this MISC, the multi-inflammatory syndrome that infects children, that makes them critically ill weeks to months after their infection. And so there's that and the suffering and the health consequences that goes on with that. We've heard about the unexplained hepatitis in children, and we still don't know the cause of it, but the evidence is mounting that that is a long COVID consequence, if you will. In other words, to say it's an autoimmune hepatitis caused by the virus. We are learning more about cardiovascular effects in people who have suffered infection. We're learning more about neurologic consequences to people. And so while certainly our initial focus was rightly on trying to preserve life, at this point, we should be having a far greater discussion in the country and in the world about protecting future health. There will be lots of consequences of this, and that, frankly, has not been part of the conversation.
And I think, Dr. Pate, when you mentioned long COVID, for anyone who has not been impacted by this, or if you don't know someone who has this, I think you may be missing the larger point. And anecdotally, I have a former colleague who has long COVID. She got COVID. She lives in Philadelphia, got it in about March of 2020. And this is someone who was in her 40s, very active, you know, was a runner. I mean, quite active, would call herself an athlete. The journey that she has been on, and she has documented this on social media, she has been in numerous studies. The impact on her life has been devastating. Things are finally, leveling out for her. But it has been quite the journey. And I think, Dr. Pate, you know, those are the things that maybe we need to be having conversations about. Maybe it's not, well, you're not going to die from this. I mean, the likelihood is you're not going to die from this if you're vaccinated. But there are other things that could greatly impact one's life.
Well, you're absolutely right. And this doesn't really become part of our daily discussion the way it should be. So, for example, even when we talk about the discussion about children and in schools and the effects on their educational performance due to the steps that were taken to control COVID, or we talk about their mental health, which are both critical issues. Do not mistake me. Those are very critical discussions. However, we don't have a complete discussion about those. We don't have a discussion about, well, how much of that academic performance is post-COVID effects? Because we are finding that not only this brain fog that we talk about in adults, it can happen after COVID. It happens in children too. And so, you know, there has to be a more complete discussion. The same thing about the mental health consequences? Well, no part of that discussion has been, well, what does COVID do to contribute to that in terms of the fact that we know that people after COVID are more likely to experience anxiety and other conditions. And we know that if you have, your family has been personally affected and you've lost a family member, that has a huge impact on kids. We just never seem to have the full discussion of all the factors, and we tend to make these overly simplistic discussions, which the problem is it's likely to lead us to coming up with the wrong long-term answer to the problem. And I'm not saying that these are easy questions, but we are certainly not as likely to get to good solutions unless we have thorough analysis of all the contributing factors.
One thing I do want to talk about in regards to long COVID is a study that that Canadian researchers are doing, Dr. Pate. I'm not sure how much you know about this or you can talk to us about this, but apparently there is a team of researchers and they think they've zeroed in on what they're calling a microscopic abnormality in the way oxygen moves from the lungs and into the blood vessels of long COVID patients. Now, this is in the trial that they did. So this could potentially be some good news for folks who greatly suffer from long COVID.
Yes, I actually read that study with great interest. And I think that, and of course there's many studies coming out on long COVID. I think once again, that will be what those Canadian researchers have found will be an overly simplistic explanation. It's important. It's important that we understand these kind of what we would call pathophysiologic explanations for why the disease occurs. I don't think that's going to be the total explanation. And the reason I don't is that we're finding other things that in other studies that it's pretty hard for me to connect these dots. For example, while I think what they found about this oxygen transfer across the lungs is certainly likely to be an important contributor because so many people, and you described your friend, you know, decreased exercise tolerance. We know a lot of people with long COVID who were very active that now the very act of climbing a single flight of stairs can put them in bed for the rest of the day, those kind of things. So it certainly may be important. But we're also seeing that there's a number of people that their major symptoms are not related to the respiratory tract, their neurologic features or other features of their disease. And so I think there may be different causes in different people. And we also find that, for example, a fair number of these people develop autoantibodies. In other words, they are developing antibodies that will attack normal parts of their body. And it's pretty hard to figure out how that would be explained by the oxygen. So I think it's going to be, you know, I think these are important pieces. I don't think this is the answer, but I think it's important pieces. And we're going to have to put this all together and come up with ways that we can look at people with long COVID with very different symptoms and determine what is it that's contributing to their symptoms? And then understanding what that pathophysiology is, how can we attack that with therapy or medications or whatever? But it's important research, but I certainly don't think it explains everything.
Before we get to listener questions, Dr. Pate, I still want to pick your brain about a couple of things. And we do know that the BA.5 is the dominant variant in the United States right now. I have heard this term being thrown around calling it a Deltacon variant, a combination of Delta and Omicron. A, is that true? And B, what does that mean exactly? Because we do know that this variant is the most transmissible. But what else do we know about it?
Yeah. Well, Gemma, we're learning a lot because it's relatively new to the scene. So with respect to this, you know, phrase that's come up, Deltacron, you know, I'm not a fan of that. And the reason is that generally when we combine those names in cute ways, it's meant to reflect that the viruses have actually combined, something we call a recombination. And what that occurs, and of course the setting has been there that could occur, where you have two different variants circulating at the same time. Certainly you can be infected by more than one variant, particularly this can happen in immunocompromised people. And it's what can happen is the viruses can exchange genetic material. We call that a recombination event. And that is something that can lead to all of a sudden very dramatic changes in the way that the virus is acting. Whereas typically what we see are just mutations where it's like if I gave you a paragraph to write and you wrote it quickly, there's a very good chance you might make some errors as you were writing it. And that those would we would call mutations, which occur when there's lots of virus replicating very fast and errors in the transcription get made so that a substitution gets made. That's different than a recombination. I don't have very good evidence to suggest that BA5 is a recombination event. We have had recombinations in the past, and they haven't really taken off, thank God. But I don't know that this one is. So I'm not ready to buy into that phraseology. Perhaps we'll find that's the case. I don't think so. I think these are just going to be the consequence of what you and I have talked about for 2 years. We have to decrease the transmission of this virus because we're only promoting more mutation events. So back to your question, what do we know? We do know that BA4 and BA5 are the most transmissible forms of this virus that we have dealt with today. So far more transmissibility. Number two, we know that of the two, BA4 and BA5, it appears clear that BA5 has a what we would call a fitness advantage over BA4 and certainly over BA1, BA2, and BA2.12.1. And what we mean by fitness advantage is it's basically line these viruses up at the starting line, you know, fire the starting gun, let them take off, and who kind of outruns who. And there's a number of reasons why viruses can have a fitness advantage that I won't go into right now. But what we're seeing is that as all of these viruses are trying to, you know, run their way through the population, BA5's taking over. And that's what you just referenced, that it's now the predominant one. It's beating out BA4 quite a bit, and it's done this in other countries. So I fully expect to see BA4 eventually kind of fizzle out. BA5 is overtaking the variant that we have been dealing with that was dominant before that, which is the BA2.12.1. Now, so why should we care? Well, first of all, if it's more transmissible, that means it's going to be more likely that you can get infected. And with less time, with less virus. And so the second thing is that not only is this virus much more transmissible, we know clearly at this point, it has the strongest degree of what we call immune escape. In other words, that it has abilities through these mutations to be less slowed down by immunity, whether infection or vaccination. Now, there's a subtle point to this that's very important to make. And in the past, and I'm talking now prior to 2022, so last year and the year before, infection-based immunity or so-called natural immunity, it was decent. It was a pretty good protection for a while. right now, if your natural immunity, if your infection-based immunity is based on the fact that you got any infection this year in 22, which would be one of these Omicron sublineages, your immune protection is pitiful. It's very slight, if any, against the currently circulating strains. The good news is that while this virus even escapes some of the vaccine-induced protection, it doesn't escape it near to the degree that it escapes earlier infection immunity. So today, the vaccinations are more important than ever. Let me just make one last point, Jim, and this relates back to something that you mentioned in the last segment. And that is, we've also confused the public because a lot of people say, well, you know, Omicron is milder. Let me make this very clear for everybody. And we have the data now to back this up. It is milder on an individual basis. So, for example, Gemma, if you were to get an Omicron infection, the chance that you would have severe disease is less than had it been that you got Delta or one of the previous ones. However, because of the fact that Omicron is so much more transmissible and has this ability to, in some degree, get this immune escape, and even though, for example, I use Delta, Delta circulated in parts of our country for like 23 weeks. Omicron, the first one, BA1, circulated for about 8 weeks. But even though it was a smaller amount of time, we had more deaths due to Omicron in certain parts of the country than due to Delta. And that's because if you have a much more transmissible virus and you infect a whole lot more people, even if it has a less severity per person, you're infecting so many more that you still end up with more deaths. So we need to always keep this in perspective. It might be milder case for you. If you're not vaccinated, you're all bets are off. So get vaccinated. We still need to treat this with respect.
And then Dr. Pate, as we see these new, variants coming out, right? How important is it then that not only are you vaccinated, but that I would assume vaccines need to also be keeping up with these new variants. And that goes to this, what we talked about last week on the show, was that we will all likely need to get another shot sometime in the fall because of the variant change. I mean, that might be really elementary the way I said it, but do you understand what I'm
saying? Well, not elementary at all. You've made two really good points, Gemma. So let me bring those home for you. The first thing is this issue about reinfections. And so many people of the mind that, reinfections don't hurt you. There's been people that have been reinfected with influenza, but, they're fine. Well, first of all, again, we need to understand this is a very different virus than influenza. And with influenza, if you look at the average time that people get reinfected, it's like 4 years. What we're talking about with this virus is people are getting reinfected in 1 to 4 months. And so you could be getting reinfected, 3-4 times a year if you're not taking precautions. We have not known what is the cumulative health effect of getting reinfected. But we do have two new studies, and one study does show us that, in fact, if you're just going to the betting track and you're going to put some money down, if you want to bet on what's going to happen with reinfections, it is you put your money on, you're going to be worse off in the end. There are certainly people that get reinfected and, is, to the best of our knowledge, are doing fine. But when you look at large populations, that when you get reinfected, you do tend to have worse health outcomes, and these can be serious health outcomes, including up to death. And I'll just remind people, our very first case of Omicron in the United States was a reinfection, and that person died, and it was a man in his 50s. So we should not shrug off reinfections. We also just have the latest study that shows that it is likely that, in fact, your outcomes worsen with each reinfection. That appears to be what the data is suggesting. So we do have to take that carefully. So now it leads to your other point you were making, and that is we may need to, it may be time for new vaccines. And I think the FDA is right on this. You don't want to switch up the vaccines too much too soon. And there's some complicated immune reasons why you don't want to do that, that I won't bore the listeners with. But when there is enough difference, and we've talked about the fact that BA5 now is far more transmissible, has much more immune escape than anything we've dealt with before, then it becomes time, yes, we should look at coming up with new vaccines. These won't be totally new. Likely what we're going to be dealing with is what we call bivalent vaccines, which mean it'll be a combination of what we previously were giving, the spike protein related to the original virus. And you're going to hear some disinformation people saying that's ridiculous to be giving because we don't have that virus anymore. They're wrong. I just can't explain it to you in 30 seconds, but they're wrong. It does make sense. And then what we will do is we'll combine that with the Omicron spike. And then that should, and studies are already showing that that's going to give us, it looks like it's going to give us a bit better protection, a fair bit more.
So bottom line is, it's when we hear about these new vaccines coming out, it's important to take that seriously and get that next round.
Well, it is, Jim, and I'll just mention one more thing, and that is Congress has not yet funded this. And therefore, the Biden administration is redistributing funds that they currently have for testing and PPE and therapeutics and so forth. And they're directing it to these new generation vaccines. The point being, they're going to be able to order about 105 million vaccines. That's what they've got money for. That means we're not going to have enough vaccines
right,
that everybody in the United States can get vaccinated. Of course, not everybody wants to, but if you're one of those that wants to get this new vaccine when it comes out, I'll be in that line. You probably don't want to dilly-dally.
Okay, that's good advice. Dr. Pate, Sarah sent us this email, and she says, after recovering from COVID, do you recommend people see a doctor for a general checkup to determine what mess COVID has done to our bodies and if it triggered an unknown health issue like blood clots?
Wow, that is a really good question.
Yeah.
We are looking to some of our professional associations to come out with clear guidance for exactly what follow-up people should have. There has been a number of health consequences identified, some of which we can test for, but we're looking for, you know, specific guidelines. those, I'm sure, are coming very soon. But yes, the answer is yes. Within a few months after your COVID infection, obviously sooner if it was a severe one, then I think it is a good idea to visit your doctor, do an assessment, see if there's anything that your physician is concerned about, and then make a plan for subsequent follow-up if there are symptoms or problems identified. But yes, that's a great question.
And Jack asks, he says, Dr. Pate, do we know why some people who lose their taste and smell when they get COVID don't get it back after having recovered?
We don't. There is a lot of interest in the research about what is going on here. What we think is the virus that is present in the nose may be going up through the what we call olfactory, which is smell, nerves and the structures that lead around that nerve up to the brain. And so we're trying to identify it. One theory, we don't have evidence for this, is that those people that didn't get it back, perhaps there was so much damage to that nerve that it's just not going to recover. Fortunately, it does recover for most, but it is a terribly annoying symptom for all of those listeners who are saying, well, what's the big deal if you lose your smell? It's one of those things you don't know what it's, you know, how important it is until you lose it. And it's very consequential. So no, we don't know yet, but an active area of investigation.
Well, and it's interesting, Dr. Pate. I mean, I've had colds in the past, right? I'm talking years ago, where sometimes they're bad enough where you've lost your taste and smell for a couple of days. And it really does impact you in ways that I don't think we appreciate.
Yeah. And in those common colds, Jim, more often what we're dealing with is that you just have nasal inflammation, you have a lot of secretions, mucus, and that drains down in the back of the throat. And so it's just, it's kind of covering up your smell and taste, if you will. Whereas it, with this virus, it is actually acting in a far more malicious way.
Okay. Jennifer just wrote in and she said, I had COVID in January of 2021 before vaccines were available for me. I was vaccinated with two shots and I received the first booster in December of 2021. Before I could get my second booster, I got COVID again. And several weeks later, I still had a cough and fatigue. Well, now that I've had Omicron, should I get the fourth booster or should I wait until the new vaccine comes out in the fall?
So I missed if she stated her age, Gemma. Did she?
She did not. No.
Okay. Well, if she's over 60, I would say, and I can give you a long reason for it, which I won't, but I would say if you're over 60, get your second booster now if you're eligible. Mostly because we're having a current surge. We may even have another one before this fall, depending on how BA5 behaves. So I would say if you're over 60 and she's had some significant consequences from prior infections, so I would get it. Again, don't count on a whole lot of protection from your Omicron infection. So yeah, I would get that. I don't think getting a second booster now is really going to have any impact on your eligibility for the new booster. I can't think of ways, and people that are smarter than me say they also don't know any reason why you still couldn't get the new booster this fall.
And then Amber emailed us. Similarly, she says she's a healthy 43-year-old woman. She's current with both of her vaccines and a booster. She has not had COVID, as far as she knows. She's traveling internationally in August. So she's asking, she says, I'm wondering if I should get another booster before travel or if those are still only recommended for immunocompromised people. I'm just concerned about getting sick when I'm traveling.
Yeah, it's an important consideration. It'd be helpful to know where specifically she's traveling because there's a lot of differences internationally about what's going on. Certain countries having real problems right now, whereas others are not having as much problem. And cases globally are going up faster than they are here in the United States, which may be that BA5. So if she told me all the facts of her question, but didn't add the international travel, I'd be saying, you know, you're 43, you're healthy. You actually have been doing the right things because you haven't gotten infected so far. So I would say, I don't know that you really need to get the second booster. Now the complication is the fact that she's going to be doing international travel. The vaccine is not authorized or recommended for her group. So I think it's going to have to be a specific discussion with her physician, and specifically take in with you the list of countries that you anticipate you're going to be traveling to, because that'll be helpful as we think about what we should be on the lookout for.
And before we wrap up today, Dr. Pate, St. Luke's starting today is offering the Pfizer vaccine for children under the age of 5 to 6 months old. St. Alphonsus announced today that it's taking appointments at 3 clinics in the Treasure Valley for the same age group of kiddos. Primary Health is offering the vaccines as well. So how much will having vaccines available for this younger set of children potentially help slow down the spread of COVID? Because we haven't necessarily seen that happen with older kids because we still don't have a lot of kids getting vaccinated.
Yeah. So, Gemma, you're hitting on an important point. It is going to be critical to get children vaccinated. Of course, from my angle, I worry about the lives and health of even a single child as a doctor. And also, but I understand most people are not really worried that their kid's going to get terribly sick. But a major public health reason for getting our kids vaccinated, especially now that we have used this vaccine hundreds of millions of times and we know it's very safe, that is to get these youngest children vaccinated because they do play an important role in the transmission of this virus. That's one of the key reasons we vaccinate children for flu. The biggest way that flu comes into homes and transmits to families and particularly high risk families is through school age children that pick it up at school. So vaccination is an important strategy for decreasing the overall amount of disease and preventing those who are at risk from ending up in hospitals or dying. While there's few other comparisons to flu with COVID, this is one where if we get our kids vaccinated, this will significantly help slow down the transmission of virus. That will be good for all of us, as I'm really tired of variants and I would like them to slow right. down.
I would agree with you. All right. We only have about 45 seconds left, but if you remember the question from Jennifer, Dr. Pate, about getting her fourth booster or waiting until the vaccine comes out in the fall, she wrote back, she said she's 52 and she's very healthy generally. So she wanted to know if you now have the same answer for that fourth booster, for her to wait.
Yeah, the critical thing would be if she was over 60, I would change my guidance and I would say, yeah, go get it right now. It's much less clear for 50, although a good case can be made, and especially given the international travel. So again, I would say discussion with the physician and take the specific country she's going to be traveling to with her for that discussion.
All right. As always, Dr. Pate, thank you so much for your time today, for answering all of our questions and keeping us up to date. Big thank you to Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. He will be back next week. So send us those emails, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Thanks, Dr. Pate.
Thank you, Gemma.